So I want to begin by encouraging you when listening to what I'm going to talk about. And anytime you're listening to a Dharma talk, I think it's really helpful to keep your attention in your body. See what's happening for you. Continue your practice of meditation by noticing what's happening for you. Notice where a little, I like that, I don't like that, I'm tired, I'm excited, all these sensations in the body, and all your reactions. And let your attention be with all of that, and let the words and the ideas come to you, flow through you, without needing to go out and get them and feel like you need to expend a lot of energy trying to grab a hold. I loved a colleague said that her objective when giving a Dharma talk is that one person hear one thing that makes a difference in their practice. So you may be that one person, you may not, but it's not, the point of Dharma talks isn't that you hear every single thing and you memorize it. That's why we get to hear them multiple times and why sometimes you hear something that you've heard before, but somehow it sinks in and you feel it in a different way. And if you stay right here, that's more likely to happen. You're likely to hear it in a different way. So that's my encouragement. So I want to talk about equanimity, this quality that, like I said before, is at the end of all these lists that really sounds, you know, when we sit, it's like, equanimity, oh, that sounds so good. That means like it's all going to be even and all this push and pull and it's all going to drop away. And there's some truth to that, and there's some illusion in that. And so some of what I want to do is sort through that. So what is equanimity? And the Pali word is upekkha, for those who don't know. And the Pali word upekkha comes from two parts. I think I have this right. I know the two meanings, but I'm not sure if I have the roots right. Upa means above. And pekka and ekka is to see. So it's to see from above is the word. And yet also in upekkha is another root that also means to see from the middle of. And so I think this is a wonderful dual meaning in the word itself. In some way to be separate and in some way to be right in the middle of. It's often talked about as a sense of balance. And the sense of balance, there's a number of other qualities, but just to stop first on that first sense of balance, it's not balance as in on a razor's edge where you're like precarious. It's as in balance that there's a big wide path and there's a solidity and clarity about your feeling and your being there. It's you know, it's often compared, this sense of balance, and another word is unshakability, steadfastness, stability, steadiness. And there's a little, it's often compared to a mountain, and this is from Li Po. The birds have vanished into the sky, and now the last cloud drains away. We sit together, the mountain and me, until only the mountain remains. And I think that that is pointing to this quality that when it's just so balanced and so clear that there's no separation, there's nothing that we have to hang on to. The birds come, they go, and there's a lot of clarity in that. That's another quality of equanimity, is clarity to be with things as they are, to see the truth, to not be pretending that they are other than they are. This quality of clarity really is speaking to the delusive aspect. Equanimity is not, oh yeah, that just happened, but I'm okay. I'm going to be just fine. That's delusion. So clarity is, oh, that was really irritating. I really feel that. I can feel it in my body. I can feel my mind getting tight. And I'm going to be okay. So feeling that sense that you can be with what's happening, see it clearly, and know this quality of impermanence, that it's going to pass, that there's space around, and that you will be okay. And in that, you may have heard also another quality of equanimity, which is confidence or faith. And this is that faith in our own capacity. And this is a really important thing, that quality that builds over time. And this is one of the things that I think our practice really, really offers us. Because when we sit here, this is part of what we're building. When we sit here and we make it through another sit, and it wasn't the one we had planned, but we build a sense of, I can do this. I will be, I can, even when it's a little hard, when it's tough, I can make it through this. I'll be all right. And as a, we have this idea that we're going to build this quality of spaciousness, of equanimity, by having sits that are all even and calm. But we're actually building this confidence that really supports the equanimity when we meet moment by moment the things in our lives or the sit where it's difficult. That's where we actually build confidence, because we begin to understand that we don't meet conditions to be a particular way, to be for us to be okay. That actually it cannot be as we wish, and it'll be all right. And in this, there develops also in equanimity, there's a sense of, real sense of warmth. This is important because, as I will talk later about the things that masquerade as equanimity, this quality of warmth is very, brings to equanimity something very different than indifference or holding off or that too much of that looking from above. It's that quality of being in contact, of actually still being connected, still caring. That warmth of the heart is still there. And this is closely connected. Equanimity has the other Brahmaviharas in it. It has the quality of joy as well. Because we have when we have this equanimity, there is coming through us a sense of aliveness. We're not being wedded to it being some particular way and trying to control our environment. And instead, we're in a place where we can be alive and responsive to what's happening. And that aliveness is an expression of our own true nature. And the ability to express that. All of you know this feeling. So just check in for a moment. Can you know those times when you feel alive and responsive? And how there's a sense of joy in that. It's not a giggle, you know. It may not be like super elated bliss, but there's just this sense of being right here. And this really points to that in this, all these different qualities of equanimity point to the fact that equanimity is not a state of nothing going on. There's lots going on. But it's being held in a much broader perspective and understanding. So I want to talk more specifically about some of the things that come in and give some examples of the things that come in and tend to, in our experience, knock us off. And the process of building equanimity around those. And this is speaking to that wisdom quality I mentioned earlier, that by actually understand and naming and seeing, then we build the reflective knowledge that when something's happening, what is going on. So the first one I'm going to mention, and so I'm going to talk for a bit about the eight vicissitudes of life. Because these are what knock us off. So the vicissitudes are praise and blame, gain and loss, fame and disrespect, pleasure and pain. So the Buddha says about praise and blame. So he says, therefore, bhikkhus, if others abuse, revile, scold, and harass you, on that account, you should not entertain any annoyance, bitterness, or dejection of the heart. And if others honor, respect, revere, and venerate you, on that account, you should not entertain any delight, joy, or elation of the heart. That first one's a little easier, and the second one is where we often get trapped. But it's so important, because what happens is if we rely on the affirmation, on the support of praise, then we're setting ourselves up for blame. We have to be willing to take it all in and let it flow through us. All of you, I'm sure, have had this experience that I certainly have it in teaching. You know, you get lots of people like what you have to say, and they, you know, appreciate it. And then somebody says something that has a negative quality. Which one do you pay attention to? Mm-hmm. None of those other ones. And that's because we've been paying attention, going along, paying attention to all those good ones. So that one other one just knocks it down. I recently, my husband is on the planning commission in Grand County, in Moab, where I live. And I was previously on the planning commission. I think we have the longest standing family representation on the planning commission. But he's the chair of the commission, and as that, gets a lot of people calling him. And it's interesting just listening sometimes to the messages. I'll be going through the messages. And it'll be from people that are on, you know, like from people who have an environmental attitude. The exact same sort of constituency group will say, you're doing great. Thanks so much for what happened on the meeting. Really appreciate your support. Somebody else saying, all the language that mattered has completely been struck. This is totally worth, and it's like not even from opposite, you know, what you would consider different sides of the same story. It's from the same group. What do you do with all that? You know, how do you sort through? And that becomes our practice, trying to discern and sort through where is there information here that is useful. And then we can actually find our way. What was mentioned to me earlier, I really appreciate that, because I really see, oh, there's a little blind spot where I might be missing, where I was missing, being inclusive with people. And we can use the information that comes in. This isn't that we're setting up a wall and saying, nobody, you know, nobody talk to me and tell me your point of view. That's not what we're doing. But we can take in, oh, the lying down was useful. You know, we can look at the different information. But the difference is whether we take it personally, whether we use it to support our sense of self, our identity. If we think it makes up who we are and our self-worth, that's where we start to tumble. Because if we make our self-worth dependent on what people say, then our self-worth is gone when people criticize us. So another one of these is gain and loss. And this is so much, you know, it almost seems like 4 or 5 years ago, for a lot of people, this was a little harder one to work with. The gain was all good, right? What's the problem? And really what's happening for us economically, really, you know, as a, I'm sure as a community here, as a nation, and in the world, really makes this come up. What is it like to say there is less? And I've seen a lot of people really, really have a lot of wisdom around this. It's been quite uplifting to me. You know, like I have a friend who doesn't have a job and is having, you know, it's not easy. And she said, and recently she said, it's great. I don't have to worry about where I'm going or where to take the next vacation or whether I'm going to be out of town when a particular event happens. I'm going to be here. And it's like, and in fact, it's actually someone who is involved in Dharma stuff, and she recently said, you know, I've decided that that's really the most important thing to me. And yes, it means I'm going to have less money, that the, a lot of the things I want to do are not really going to generate much income, but that's what I want to do. And I'm going to make the choice to have less in this material world. And when we think about it, this quality of less is going to happen for all of us ongoing. You know, we had so much of our culture and our momentum in this country has been to more and more and more and more. More comfort, more stuff, you know, on and on. And the world can't do it. Our planet can't do it. And it's going to be part of all of us, our ongoing challenge, to realize that our happiness is not dependent on that. That we can have less and be happy. In fact, you know, I mean, I really remember there was a study group back in Moab, and I think there were in many places 10, 15 years ago, of voluntary simplicity and the wisdom of actually cutting back purposefully. Well, for those who didn't do it on purpose, we're going to all get to do it together. But I think the wisdom of the voluntary simplicity is available to us. That this isn't a negative thing. And when we were caught up in thinking that more was what is going to solve it, it was a setup. It's a setup. Another one is the fame and disrepute. And that's very similar to the praise and blame. But it has to do with a little bit more, not just the moment, Terry, receiving of that, but how we feel we're sort of standing up in our community and among people we know. And I was trying to think of a good example because I don't have one off the top of my head. But I think I think you know what it is. Yeah, there's about a million. There are obvious ones. They're all the candidates. Mm-hmm. Talk yes. about fame and disrepute. They go up and down like this by the day, right? There are the top person on the list doing great. Somebody says something, and if they're, you know, that's where their momentum is. That's what they're trying to be, is have that fame, and it shows how fragile it is. It just gets pulled out from under people constantly. And those of us who are less famous may have less of an issue with this one. But it still comes up probably in smaller ways. I'm thinking of a woman that I've worked with who worked at a school, got good references, you know, got good evaluations. And then a boss changed. And all of a sudden, it's sort of like she didn't really quite know what happened. She was suspended from her job. And she was like uncomfortable walking down the hallway, and there were all these stories going around. And it took her a year to sort of
plow her way through the pieces, and it was so painful, because this was her heartfelt work. And to slowly try to figure out what was actually her responsibility, again, that sorting out, and then what wasn't. And in her case, in this woman's case, it was a year of huge spiritual growth, huge mm-hmm. spiritual growth, because she really saw how she had to find the self-respect, the self-confidence from inside, that her job, where her identity had been tied up, was fragile, and it could be pulled out from under her. So the last one is pleasure and pain. And this one can be on the small, just what's pleasant. This is so insidious for us. So insidious, because we go after the pleasant. It's not, we can't help it. We're wired that way. We're warm-blooded animals who like to be, you know, have sensual pleasures, be warm, be loved, all these different things, and we move towards what is pleasant. And it's so important over and over to remember just that, like that William Blake poem, to have the pleasant is not a problem. It's not a problem. We can enjoy what's pleasant. In fact, that is considered the big difference between the householder life and the monastic life, is that householders can continue, and there's nothing wrong with continuing to enjoy sensual pleasure. But don't attach to it. Don't cling to it. Don't make your happiness depend on it. Now, in this, the Buddha is talking not only of simple pleasant pleasure and pain, but actually pleasant and unpleasant. Much sort of the whole category, all of these things all feed into what is pleasant and unpleasant. You can see how gain and loss are pleasant and unpleasant. So everything comes into that. What does one cognize with the consciousness? One cognizes this is pleasant. One cognizes this is painful. One cognizes this is neither painful nor pleasant. In dependence on a contact to be felt as pleasant, there arises a pleasant feeling. So what that means, you know, something happens and something we see is pleasant. We acknowledge it as pleasant. When one feels a pleasant feeling, one understands, I feel a pleasant feeling. One understands with the cessation of that same contact to be felt as pleasant, its corresponding feeling, the pleasant feeling that arose in dependence on that contact to be felt as pleasant, ceases and subsides. So when the thing that created the pleasant sensation goes away, the pleasant feeling goes away. You can't hang on to it. You can't just be, it went away by grabbing and keeping on to it. It will not stay. Then you have moved from pleasant feeling into clinging, which is not pleasant. In dependence on a contact to be felt as painful, there arises painful feeling. And so when I feel pleasant, he understands or she understands the cessation of the same contact, the corresponding feeling of pain disappears. Mm-hmm. So same thing. That thing that happened yesterday that was painful is over. Mm-hmm. What's causing you pain now is not the thing that happened, but you're hanging on to it. Bhikkhus. Just as from the contact and friction of two fire sticks, heat is generated and fire is produced, and with the separation and disjunction of those two fire sticks, and the corresponding heat ceases and subsides, so too, in dependence on a contact to be felt as pleasant or to be felt as painful, to be felt as neither, one understands with the sensation of either, it subsides. Then there remains only equanimity, purified and bright, malleable, wieldy, and radiant. Suppose, Bhikkhu, A skilled goldsmith or his apprentice were to prepare a furnace, heat up the crucible, take some gold with tongs and put it into the crucible. From time to time he would blow on it, from time to time he would sprinkle water on it. That gold would become refined, well refined, completely refined, faultless. Then whatever kind of ornament he could make, it would serve its purpose. So too, bhikkhus, then there remains only equanimity, purified and bright, malleable, wieldy, and radiant. So he doesn't say the pleasant isn't going to happen, the unpleasant isn't going to happen. But when it happens, it happens. When it goes, it goes. And what remains is equanimity. This is from William Stafford, The Way It Is. There's a thread you follow. It goes among things that change, but it doesn't change. People wonder about what you are pursuing. You have to explain about the thread. But it is hard for others to see. While you hold it, you can't get lost. Tragedies happen, people get hurt or die, and you suffer and get old. Nothing you do can stop time's unfolding. You do not ever let go of the thread. And my interpretation is this is what he's pointing to there, this thread that holds us, that has a bigger sense to it. And as we have this perspective and this sense, we develop a lot of patience. We develop a lot of willingness, patience that is not patience for, that is not tolerance, that is not waiting for something to happen. Sometimes patience can feel like it's patience that is waiting for. But there's a patience that is right here. And that is so closely tied in there with equanimity. And what we can do is watch for all the places that we are arguing with that, where we have a view that is separating us from having that view. You know, there's the funny ways. You can check and see where you might have something that kind of fits into this, but we don't say it quite this bluntly to ourselves. But I'll say the blunt versions. I would have a great marriage if it weren't for my spouse. My job would be excellent if it weren't for the work that I did and my boss. This would be a perfect sit if only you fill in the gap. And often we don't say it to ourselves quite that bluntly, but really it's in there, you know? And so we're developing this like, oh, I'm sidetracking myself here. I've got an idea. And no, this is the way it is. And how do we, you know, and things are difficult. None of this is to undercut the fact that life can be really hard. For a long time I had this phrase that came up a lot to me, which was, it's hard to be a person. It just felt really real to me. It's hard to be a person. And as we feel that, and as we go in and interact with life, it's not uncommon for us to have reactivity, that we've learned that over time. This question came up a couple nights ago about reactivity. Causes and conditions through our history, our childhood, what's happened to us yesterday, the food we ate this morning, the sleep we didn't get, all the things come into this moment and something happens and we don't like it. It happens. But what we can learn to do is recognize reactivity for what it is. That we're having a spontaneous response to something that has happened that is not have mindfulness and clarity and this spaciousness of equanimity anywhere in sight. And what that tells us, the most important thing that tells us, is don't do anything. Don't do anything that might increase the suffering of yourself or other people. What we need in that is time. We need to get some perspective. We need to get some space around what's happening. Now, this isn't, you know, there can be reactivity. Somebody's about to run into the street. You don't, like, wait until you're non-reactive. You stop the person from running into the child from running into the street. I'm not talking about anything that extreme. But what I'm talking about is the way that we can be reactive out of our anger or out of our sadness or our hurt or just not being heard in the way we want to be heard, not being seen in the way we want, and the reactivity that can come out of that. Also the reactivity that can come out of, I want that. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what I want. And the way we might sort of, you know, try to dodge around somebody in some way or say something that where somebody seems to be thwarting us getting what we want. The more we can notice that, without being embarrassed of it. This is really important because the more we're embarrassed or shameful of our own reactivity, the more we tend to act and dodge around it. That we actually need to own it. And we need to realize other people are reactive too. And give them permission to be reactive and the space to not do something. I know I don't want to make any blanket, in fact I know there's some contradictions to this in the room, but I know myself and other women that I've talked to tend to have a thing that, like, if they have a partner, that it's like something happens and they want to talk about it. I want to work it out. And it's taken me a long time, embarrassingly long time, to realize that my partner, if he's reactive, that to let him have his wisdom of not talking about it and working it out right then. That to actually say, oh, there's reactivity going on there. It's probably going on here too. And just to let there be space. That it doesn't have to be solved right now. And a lot of things actually do simply go away. They really just are not as big a thing. As soon as the way I can say I'm probably being reactive is because I need to talk about it. That's a clue, right? Mm-hmm. That I've got some grip going. And one thing that's really important in this whole process that I touched on there is that there's a natural unfolding going on. In somebody that's being reactive, it's not their fault in the sense that it's a whole history unfolding. And they have the possibility in that moment to try to see if slowly over time they can change that. But it's already happened. They're already reactive. I'm already reactive. And this is part of our karma, our history playing out. Not only in those sorts of situations, but when we really care deeply about other people or we care about the world, we may, you know, this wanting to solve things, there's a resistance sometimes in the wanting to solve them. A few years ago, I was doing a retreat on the Lost Coast, and it was we often see sea lions, but that year it was quite heart-wrenching. There were all these just incredibly adorable sea lion pups up on the shore, and at first we thought, oh look, isn't that cute, it's up there, and then slowly it became apparent that they were all in different stages of dying. And it was just, it was devastating. And in that, there was also the sense that I have now when I see something like that. We didn't know why, you know, because we were on the coast, we didn't know why. But I have to say there was a sense of,
the way things are in the world right now, that people are probably, we, myself included, are in some way maybe responsible for this. Mm-hmm. And that really made it even more devastating. And there wasn't any way to, I couldn't wish that away. Mm-hmm. I couldn't wish away either the incredible sadness or the sense of responsibility. Mm-hmm. And it didn't feel, it wasn't useful. To push it away would be delusion. And yet, to realize that these things were happening as a result of a longer history. You know, it's the karma unfolding of our culture, of our world. And how to take that in and then respond from here to feel the impact and move forward in a skillful way and not become overcome with sadness and grief. This is something that's really, I think, very much happens for people right now, because there is so much of this impact coming back and we're really seeing it. And how to touch it, to feel it in contact, what's happening, without being lost. And one thing that helps in this is to realize we are of no use to ourselves or anyone else when we are overwhelmed in grief. That we actually can't act skillfully from there. That part of the way that we actually can move forward is to care, but have some space and some ability to move. I mentioned earlier that quality of there is nothing worth clinging to. Sometimes we can have the idea that it's worth clinging to our idea of what is right, or clinging to our anger, that these are the things that are going to help us be able to make a difference, to solve things. And that it is this clinging, this hanging on, this in the world that is the source, along with the greed. You know, it's what creates the suffering. So our task is to find the place of compassion, of caring, this warmth within the equanimity that allows us to go forward without getting submerged. And like what I was saying about the economics, this relationship to the world and what's happening, this quality is going to become more and more demanded of us if we're going to make skillful change and be of use in the world, is how do we hold this big picture, be touched deeply, but not be submerged in the grief. It's like becoming like willows in the creek bottom, a resilience. The big flood comes and they get completely tipped over, and then it goes and they stand back up. And in a lot of ways, this quality of equanimity is this resilience to keep coming back. And even, and cottonwoods are this amazing resilient. They lose this limb, and then they lose this one. And then the whole tree knocks over and they sprout up again. You know, I mean, there's a beautiful quality in that. And they're such beautiful trees. All that happens, and they're beautiful trees, and they provide shade and habitat, and you know, there's a quality there that we too can offer. The quote from the Buddha is, "The unshakable balance of mind endowed with great care." It's beautiful. And what I've been speaking to here is not the reactivity, that was where we started, but now I'm speaking to the possibility of responsiveness, to taking it in and then responding, to being able to move, to find what might be skillful. And this responsiveness allows that aliveness I was speaking about earlier, our own individual
qualities and attributes and abilities to come through and respond. It doesn't mean there's a preset have to what it's supposed to look like. We're now in a relationship with what's happening around us and allowing what is here to come through and respond. Because there's this bigger space. There's not something grabbing a hold of us and saying it has to be a certain way. The last thing I do want to mention, because to not mention it would be to... I want to read you a couple of poems, short poems, haiku, in honor of the full moon. This quality of equanimity that includes everything, from Basho. Since my house burned down, I have a better view of the rising moon. And then from Izumi Shikubu. Although the wind blows terribly here, the moonlight also leaks between the roof planks of this ruined house. But the last thing I want to mention is that it's not useful to cling even to equanimity. Shucks. So this is what the Buddha says. Here, Ananda, a bhikkhu is practicing thus. If it were not, it would not be mine. It will not be, and it will not be mine. What exists, what has come to be, that I am abandoning. Thus he obtains equanimity. He delights in that equanimity, welcomes it, and remains holding to it. As he does so, his consciousness becomes dependent on it and clings to it. A bhikkhu Ananda who is affected by clinging does not attain nibbana. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to end with one more quote from the Buddha. When liberation of mind by equanimity is developed, no limiting action remains there. None persists there. Just as a vigorous trumpeter could make herself heard without difficulty in the four quarters, so too, when equanimity is developed, no limiting action remains there. None persists there. That's it. So there's one more quote I want to read to you from Ajahn Amaro that relates this quality that we're talking about, this equanimity, to space and awareness, to the quality of citta, for the mind of awareness. The citta itself is totally still. It has no movement. It is not related to all that arises and ceases. It is silent and spacious. Mind objects, sights, sounds, smells, taste, touch, thoughts, and emotions flow through it. Problems arise because the clarity of the mind gets entangled with sense impressions. By contemplating our own experience, we can make a clear distinction between the mind that knows, the citta, and the sense impressions that flow through it. Thank you for your kind attention.